are on bank earnings watch, or we're almost, our watch is almost done, at least for the week, with Goldman Sachs' report this morning. But as we heard from our Brian Chung earlier in the week, one theme has really emerged. There are several themes. One of the themes that has emerged is that loan growth has not picked back up yet. And in a lot of these banks, investment banking revenue is making up for that. Let's bring in Jeff Hart now, Piper Sandler Managing Director and Senior Research Analyst. He covers the banks. Jeff, does it matter, first of all? And second of all, when do you think that that tipping point is going to be? Is it going to be in the fourth quarter? Is it going to be further out?
Yeah, I mean, loan growth absolutely matters for the banks. That's probably going to be kind of the driver of the next catalyst up. I still think it's a matter of when, not if. I don't know if it'll necessarily be fourth quarter, as it fall into first quarter of next year. But I mean, we're seeing all the underlying drivers and signs of loan growth. And we actually saw some loan growth this quarter so far. I mean, it hasn't been very much, but we've really seen some growth. But I don't think, you know, seeing mid-single digit, you know, loan growth for next year is a stretch. I would expect to see that and hope that there could actually be some upside to that, because that's until the short-term interest rates go up, which is, you know, something the Fed may have to be the one to do. Loan growth is really the key to net interest income getting better for the banks.
Jeff, earnings estimates into this round of earnings, they went up. They went up a lot depending on which company you track, but we're still seeing sizable beats on the bottom line. Where are the surprises coming from?
I mean, capital markets has been a highlight, and typically, you know, this is the summer slowdown, right? It's usually the weakest quarter of the year, but especially in trading and M&A, we're seeing record quarters. So, I mean, investment banking and trading, the capital markets businesses are actually quite a bit stronger than I think we expected coming in, and we thought it would be a decent quarter. The thing people are really looking at, though, is, you know, what's the outlook? What do you see through the windshield as opposed to in the rearview mirror? What was a good quarter? And the outlook at this point, I think, still looks pretty good. But, you know, capital markets strength, resilience is really what at least the Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley's of the world, I think, need to see to kind of take another leg up.
Yeah, and let's talk about Goldman for just another moment here. I mean, Goldman Sachs seemed to have, if not lost its mojo over the past several years, was not sort of the unquestioned, you know, best in class. And this quarter, things came back a little bit. Is this a function of the environment, or is it a function of David Solomon's execution?
I think it's a little bit of both. The environment certainly helps, because at the end of the day, Goldman is still the biggest and probably the best investment bank out there. So, you know, the last three, four quarters where capital markets have been really strong, Goldman has been shining. Before that, when capital markets weren't quite as great, yeah, it wasn't quite as good. But we're also seeing a lot of progress in some of the strategic initiatives. I mean, their loan balances are up 9% sequentially this quarter. That's pretty good growth. And we're seeing stuff like transaction banking. So in addition to a lot of the strategic kind of delivering on things that they've promised, this is also a great environment for capital markets, and they're the premier franchise there.
Jeff, it seemed, at least to me, a little bit of a different tone at Wells Fargo. CEO Charlie Scharf talking about a turn in the corporate culture. You look down at the expense line items, they look to have cut a lot of expenses from their business. Is the Wells Fargo turnaround really truly starting to take hold?
Well, in fairness, my coworker Scott Seifers covers Wells Fargo. I think the issue we're kind of seeing there is somebody's regulatory and kind of compliance issues take a long time to get behind you. So, I mean, I think when you look at Wells Fargo, that's a great franchise. That's going to be a stock you want to own long term. But in the near term, it's just kind of, you know, getting the asset cap lifted and kind of getting expenses under control. It's just, I think, proven to be a little longer of a wait than people had hoped. And the stock, along with a lot of bank stocks, has been strong this year. It certainly had a good last, you know, 4 or 6 weeks.
And so as we go ahead into the fourth quarter and beyond, I mean, we've had so many investors come on and tell us they like the banks. What does this quarter do? I mean, does it confirm and then people stay pat and look for more outperformance from the banks? Or is now a good time to sort of take a step back as we wait for the next phase of growth?
Well, it's awfully tough to time that next step forward. And when I look at kind of the underlying fundamentals, I think they're all saying that next step forward is going to come. So I wouldn't necessarily be taking profits here, though a lot of what you might call the easy money may have already been made. But, you know, typically bank stocks trade a lot with the 10-year, even though it doesn't matter that much for their fundamental businesses. They do trade with the 10-year, and the 10-year going up is really giving them some tailwinds. But, you know, keep an eye out for pickup in loan growth, some improvement in short-term rates. And of course, if capital markets type stuff can remain strong, I think that the banks can kind of continue their move up.
We'll be watching them. Great to catch up with you, Jeff. Thanks for your time this morning. Jeff Hart of Piper Sandler. Appreciate it.
NBA star Kyrie Irving's days may be numbered with the Brooklyn Nets. The New York Post reporting the team has not discussed an extension with the player. He is now in his third year of a four-year contract. This comes after Irving refused to get the COVID-19 vaccine, essentially ruling him ineligible for the upcoming season, which begins next week. Let's bring in Lynn Elmore. He's former NBA player and Columbia senior lecturer. We've also got Dr. Robbie Sicca. He's COVID sports and society workgroup chair. Lynn, let me start with you. It's great to have both of you on. As a former player, I just want to get your thoughts on this debate that's been playing out. Clearly, the NBA is working around mandates that are existing in the individual cities they're playing. In New York, you're required to get a vaccine to play indoors. What do you think this just does for the team? But more importantly, how do you see it as a former player?
Well, I think that choices have consequences. And Kyrie Irving has incurred the consequences for his stance. But I think from a player's standpoint, and we look at it not necessarily from a business perspective, although that's important. I think, you know, Kyrie's position contradicts everything he and other NBA players have said and stood for regarding social justice. You know, according to the CDC, the Black communities incurred the highest death rate per 100,000 from COVID, more than any other ethnicities, and three times that of white people. And the ingrained racism in the United States separates Black folks from quality health care and creates economic disparities, which prevent access to quality nutrition and health education. And all of these have had an adverse impact on Black death rates. So when Kyrie says that he's doing what's best for him, you know, considering the dynamics, his platform, his influence, and his voice, you know, that's not a laudable statement. The first thing we're taught in civics class is that with individual rights come responsibility. So, you know, in my opinion, his statement is one of arrogance and selfishness, and it obviously needs to change. And I think other players are starting to put pressure on him for that change.
Yeah. And doctor, I suppose, you know, when we think about where we're at in this pandemic, you know, there are some people who might point out, look, weren't we just trying to get to herd immunity? And isn't that what this is about? And you saw the vaccination rates there on the screen. I suppose there might be some people out there listening and watching Kyrie make this decision and say, aren't enough players vaccinated? And I suppose the flip side to that would be, isn't it probably not fair to then change the rules for some players and not others? But I mean, what's the medical take around all this?
Well, that's a really good question, Zach, and thanks for having me this morning. I think the important thing to remember here is that we're still in the throes of this. And, you know, Dr. Peter Hote has talked about we could have another spike in Texas, and we're at 80% of our peak hospitalization here in Minnesota right now. So we're not through this. And treating individuals who aren't vaccinated, we have to have rules and guidelines and accountability, as Len alluded to. I mean, in the end, we have 2,000 people who are dying each day across our country from a preventable disease. And I think we have to have rules and expectations for people that are going to protect public health. This is less about personal choice and more about public health, more about the general welfare. And for individual athletes who are out there around kids, around at-risk individuals, I think it's about providing the same level of support that they provide for you as a fan. It's about providing that same level of concern for them. Because you're around them, you're there giving them high fives and giving them autographs. You have to value their health in the same way that they value you as a basketball player and you as a human being.
Len, how do you think other teams in the league respond here? Not necessarily to questions around the vaccine, but more to Kyrie Irving. As we said, he's in the third year of a four-year contract. He's had personnel issues in the past as well, not necessarily with the Nets, but when he was with the Boston Celtics too. You think his days are numbered in the league, or you think other teams could pick him up?
Oh, absolutely. He is an extraordinary talent. And, you know, while the Nets have done a pretty good job of essentially protecting themselves, you know, they're ridding themselves of a distraction that could cost them more money. And they're placing the team's interests ahead of an individual's. And I think that message has been sent to players throughout the league. They fully understand the team's position. But some would say, and I would kind of agree rhetorically, you know, why are we singling out Kyrie Irving? You know, yes, he's a star basketball player. NBA fans have had a huge emotional investment in their favorite players like him. And that's why so many irrationally come to his defense. But he's just one person taking a discordant stand. You know, in the bigger picture, you know, we ought to be angered and decrying situations like a large number of America's police forces, where in the last year, police officers who frequently come in contact with the public are dying at a rate four times more than they're dying from criminally inflicted gunshot wounds, yet their unions are balking at mandates that they should be fully vaccinated. You know, threats of walkouts and resignations, you know, are used to blackmail the public into keeping them from getting vaccinated. Compare Kyrie Irving to that, and I think the latter is, you know, the type of hypocrisy and entitlement that should be news. Kyrie Irving is, you know, one person who's making a big mistake. And I know he's a celebrity, but there are much bigger fish to fry out here.
And, Doctor, I suppose when you look at kind of the bigger picture, as Mr. Elmore there is laying it out, I mean, obviously it matters. These decisions maybe kind of spiral and impact a lot of people. But, I mean, what have you seen? I suppose we've seen vaccination rates continue to rise. I mean, as a doctor watching it all play out, I mean, how worried are you that the spillover effect could be larger than just one person, one team here?
Well, I think as a country, we need to start to talk about long COVID more than we talk about mortality associated with COVID. We know that there's individuals who have long-term implications from COVID. The Biobank study from England talked about long-term memory implications. And we know that there's a lot of other things that are associated with COVID that haven't been associated with other viruses. So we really need to start to have real conversations about what are the real public health implications? And we need to start to prepare ourselves for the fact that this is the most educated population in the history of the world in terms of healthcare. We need to learn how to handle misinformation. And I applaud you guys for trying to get the right information out each day on your broadcast. That's what we need more of. We need the right information getting out to mainstream media, to the mainstream population, so that there's new voices out there. And encouraging people in the same way LeBron James shared his very personal decision about getting vaccinated. That's great. Make it personal. Share who you are when you have that platform. It's okay to ask questions, but you have to be willing to take that information back and process it and share the why then. And I give LeBron a lot of credit for how he handled it.
Yeah, LeBron very open about saying that he was, in fact, skeptical early on. But he says he did his research and chose to get vaccinated. Okay. Len Elmore, former NBA player and Columbia senior lecturer, and Dr. Ravi Sikka, COVID Sports and Society Work Group Chair. It's good to have both of you on today. I really appreciate the time.
Today, we got a SmackDown coming for WWE SmackDown, a wrestling match to end all matches here as All Elite Wrestling faces off in primetime with WWE SmackDown for the first time. A very interesting back and forth shaping up for the battle in primetime. WWE SmackDown, of course, going to be on FS1, AEW going to be on TNT, and we've seen AEW add a bit of a pre-show to, further fuel the battle taking place and the overlap between the two wrestling giants. And for more on that battle brewing tonight, very happy to bring in the CEO of AEW, Tony Khan, joins us here. Of course, also a co-owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars, alongside Yahoo Finance's Reggie Wade, who, of course, is a big wrestling fan. And Tony, I mean, when we look at this, I'm sure you're licking your chops to get a chance to go up head-to-head with WWE SmackDown. But talk to me about what you're doing to maybe make it a no-brainer for fans out there.
Well, AEW right now, we're on a great run. We've had great shows. It's a little bit different for us this weekend. We have normally a Wednesday night show, Wednesday night Dynamite, and we have this great show we do every Friday, like we're doing tonight, Friday Night Rampage on TNT. And this weekend, because of a lot of sports on TNT, they've time shifted Dynamite to Saturday, which is Kind of crazy for us because we've had six straight weeks recently where Dynamite's been the number one show on all of cable Wednesday nights. So we're on a great run. And now we're launching Friday Rampage, which has also had some great weeks and ranked as high as number one on cable a few times. So tonight's a huge opportunity for us. I was surprised when I found out we had head-to-head competition tonight because it's kind of a first. But we rise to these challenges, and we have the best wrestlers in the world and the best wrestling in the world. So AEW on TNT, I strongly encourage people to check it out. We've grown our fan base internationally and built a big audience also overseas and in Canada, where we've been the number one rated wrestling show, and in the UK, where every single week we have the most watched wrestling show at AEW. So tonight on TNT, AEW Rampage is going to be the best wrestling show of the Friday night for sure.
Tony, Reggie Wade here. On September 22nd, you guys went into Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York. And as I was pulling up to the show, the line stretched all the way to Citi Field, which is across the street. And there was just electricity and a magnetism in the air. And you love to see it as a wrestling fan. But my question is, are you leading a wrestling revolution or is this an evolution?
Well, it's a great question, Reggie. First of all, thank you so much for coming to Arthur Ashe Stadium and being there for AEW Grand Slam. You know, we had a great event there, and because of great fans like you, we made it the most attended wrestling show in New York City in over a decade by any wrestling company, by anybody. It was a huge success to have 20,000 people there, including you, Reggie. It was a dream come true. And I think what we're doing, it's both. This is a revolution for the fans. That happens to be the name of our Q1 pay-per-view event, which has been very successful for us. And we built this big audience on TV and on pay-per-view and have really evolved a business model, I think. I try not to oversaturate the pay-per-view world with too many shows. And when we do them, they're huge. So we've had four quarterly linear and streaming pay-per-view specials. Those have done really, really well for us. We do, like I said, four a year, and each of them are up year over year. So the Q1 pay-per-view is up year over year. Our Q2 and Q3 shows, Double or Nothing and All Out, now we've done those three times, and each year they've gone up. And our last show, All Out, which was just last month in Chicago area, it was right before that Grand Slam show Reggie was at. That was our biggest pay-per-view of all time. And it was the biggest pay-per-view done by any independent wrestling company, any company other than the WWE, since the 90s. We just sold over 200,000 units, over 205,000 worldwide, I think now. And it's been a huge success for us, thanks to great wrestling fans like you, Reggie. So thank you very much.
Tony, AEW has a stacked roster. How do you balance between the already established superstars, the CM Punks, the Bryan Danielsons, the Chris Jerichos, the John Moxleys, and how do you balance that with the Jungle Boys, the Darby Allins, the MJFs, the Sammy Guevaras? Is there enough room for all of
Absolutely.
Those
names? That's what's great about the launch of AEW Rampage. Now we have two shows and more opportunities tonight, Friday night, live on TNT, and then also Dynamite, which is this week going to be on Saturday, but normally, you know, about 50 times a year, you're going to see on a Wednesday. And this just happens to be one of the rare occasions where we're not. But I'm very excited about the opportunity. I mean, it's a great thing in sports when you have a very deep roster. And when you're in management, trying to manage that roster, as I have to, when you're booking the matches, it means you have to really take advantage of the opportunities you have. And to have another show now with Rampage on Friday nights has allowed us more opportunities. And also, you can do both. I mean, CM Punk made his return to wrestling on this huge All Out pay-per-view last month. He'd been out for 7 years. He is quite possibly the biggest name in all of professional wrestling. And it's been a huge attraction for us. And he came back against Darby Allin. And they had a tremendous match. Darby Allin's a young, exciting wrestler. And, you know, CM Punk absolutely put a spotlight on a young star. And Darby Allin's been a star for us. Yeah. He's been a longest reigning TNT champion and, you know, went into his 10th defense of the title. So we've had, you know, a mix. And MJF, who you mentioned, is really one of the young rising stars in wrestling of any age. Forget about the fact, you know, he's not even 25 years old. So it's really a great time for us.
Tony, we have to ask you really quickly about the Jaguars, an 0-5 record, bumpy ride since Urban Meyer took over. And you said that he needs to regain your trust and confidence when the viral video.
I didn't say that. My father said that.
Are you confident that he can finish out the season?
Urban, that was a statement my dad put out. I've spent a lot of time with Urban. I worked together really closely with him and, of course, with my dad. And I manage the statistics and analytics for the Jaguars, which, of course, for you here on Yahoo Finance, being numbers people, is really right up your alley. So what I do for the Jaguars, my father owns a team. I've looked for like undrafted players and try to use analytics to find efficiencies in the game. And I think we've done a good job of that aspect of the game. James Robinson is a player who I found using analytics and, you know, managing the undrafted free agent process. He's one of the players that I've overseen signing. But, you know, as far as what's been happening, we absolutely want to win games. And I'll leave it to my dad and Urban to make the statements on the rest of that.
And of course, Urban Meyer making his AEW cameo earlier this year as well, which I'm sure the crossover there is likely to continue. But Tony Khan, I appreciate you coming on here and chatting with us today. AEW CEO, we'll see how the SmackDown battle goes tonight. Alongside, of course, our thanks to Reggie Wade as well.
The United States is alone among wealthy countries in its lack of a national paid leave program. Instead, we've got a patchwork of federal, state, and local policies. But our next guest is working to change that. Alexis Ohanian is the founder of 776 and co-founder and former executive chair of Reddit. And he joins us over the phone. Alexis, always good to have you here on Yahoo Finance. So look, you've been a longtime advocate of national paid leave. For those who don't know, when your daughter, Alexis Olympia, was born, you took 4 months off. Not a lot of Americans can do that. Before we get into the specifics, just why do you think it's taken so long for the U.S. to get up to speed when it comes to parental paid leave with the rest of the world?
Well, Alexis, and great to be on here and chatting with you. It's complicated because the United States is a country that talks about family values as a priority. Both parties do. This country, I think, culturally talks a lot about valuing family and it being the bedrock of society. And I think the talk is finally running out for more and more Americans who realize that we are owed this opportunity. When a new life comes into our families, that is the most crucial time for both parents to be able to be there and a part of it. And no parent should have to choose between being with their newborn and their partner or saving their career. And I was lucky because I ran the company. I took full advantage of the policy that we had at Reddit. But so many Americans, and especially so many men, don't have the opportunity for parental leave or paternity leave. And that needs to change. And I think the government now has a chance to step up and give the people what we want.
And Alexis, thank you. I'm going to be the Karina that interjects between the two other Alexises.
Sure.
Thank you so much for being here. I wanted to ask you, so you partner with Dove on this sort of initiative for parental leave. Tell me why you decided to do it and describe the partnership, if you will.
Sure. So I've been working with Dove Mental Care to advocate for parental leave since 2019. And we first introduced this pledge for paternity leave. We had thousands of parents sign. We brought their stories to Congress. I mean, we literally went to Congress, met with members of the House and the Senate, not just me, but also other dads who either had or didn't have the opportunity to get paternity leave themselves, and brought those stories. And it made a heck of a difference. In the wake of that, we actually got 12 weeks of paid family leave for all federal employees signed into law. And that was, I think, the start of some momentum that will hopefully culminate this year as we get this not just for, you know, federal employees, but for all Americans.
But, you know, when you think about, certainly there has to be a legislative effort here, Alexis, but also what needs to happen in terms of the way society views parents taking time off? Because I think there's this sort of unspoken idea that you are super parent if you can come back to the office quicker, you know, after having your baby.
Yeah, and we need to dispel that myth. And part of that is from, let's say, type A business leaders like myself, you know, showing that actually, no, what's most important is to make sure that the home front, you know, the castle is secure and sound before you can even consider doing your best work. And I know for all of my employees, I push them, especially the men, to take this time, because that's what's going to ultimately change the culture. And you're right. Yes, parents, men and women, must feel empowered to take leave. And this needs to get normalized. And certainly women bear the higher sort of brunt of this today in the workplace. But they shouldn't, it shouldn't be a liability just to have a uterus in America. It really should be something that every new parent sees an opportunity to take, even and especially the men. And I think the way this changes is in particular more and more men normalizing it, more and more men talking about it. And what excites me is that this new generation of male CEOs in particular that we invest in and back at 776, they are more motivated and more aware than ever about not only providing this for their employees, but then taking advantage of it and talking about it. And look, how many of us have been on Zoom calls in the last couple of years and had our kids barge in or drop through, maybe not always on live television like that guy on the BBC, but even that normalization makes a difference. No one of us who has a child can really say that there is a gulf or a barrier between work and life. It blurs. And this is the most crucial moment in welcoming a new member to the family that we need every American to have to be able to have access to paid leave.
And I feel like I may be the anomaly here or the crazy person in the room, mm-hmm. because I had my child, yeah. I remember, 10 weeks early. She was in ICU for 6 of those weeks. And I was begging my boss, please let me come back to work because I just wanted some normalcy in my day. But, you know, it was great to have that flexibility and obviously be offered the time to take as much time as I needed to be at home with my child, obviously. Cool. I wanted to ask you, in this sort of worker-driven economy job market right now, how important is it to offer parental leave when employers are looking at recruiting, you know, people for jobs?
Well, so it is vital. Offering paid leave it's become table stakes in the tech industry where the talent war is the most fierce. And, you know, my founding partner here at 776, Kaylin Holloway, she was our head of people and culture at Reddit and created that policy that I ended up taking. We know now for anyone trying to attract the best and the brightest and retain them, you need to have this policy. Now, that's great for companies that are, you know, that have millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, lots of money to invest in their employees. Small businesses, though, are such a crucial part of the economy. They don't have the access necessarily to those kinds of dollars. And that's why a federal policy is so important, because it's going to lead to healthier outcomes for all. And I want to say this, look, I say none of this to your personal story. I want every American to have the option. And I really do think that at the end of the day, it's not to prescribe you have to take the time. And more importantly, it's to give the peace of mind and the flexibility. And I've had employees who have had their third kid and they say, look, you know what, Alexis, to be honest, like, we got this. Like, I'll take a few weeks off and then we're going to be fine. But I still push them to say, look, at least consider taking off every Friday after that and work a 4-day work week or whatever. Again, whatever works for you and your family. But you can use this time flexibly, and just that little bit of difference gives your family more freedom. It gives your partner a day of support. It gives whatever. It gives you optionality, and no one's going to miss you if you take, let's say, that one day out of the week. Like, it's changing the mindset around it being this binary thing that also I think this will accomplish, because I mean, that's exactly how I thought, actually, until I got presented with building our paid leave strategy. And I was like, oh, okay, this makes a lot of sense for folks. And it's that opportunity, because at the end of the day, I don't think there's a single one of us in this country who wants an American to have to choose between their kid and their partner and a paycheck. That decision, yeah. It is to be put in that place is not something I think any American should want, because the families really are the bedrock, and we deserve to make sure everyone has that opportunity.
Absolutely. Hey, look, Alexis, since we have you here, I got to ask you a couple of tech questions. Yeah. Quick. I know there's been a lot of A lot of reports out there that Reddit, the company you co-founded, is getting closer to becoming, going public. We don't know for sure yet. And I know that in 2020, they had revenue of $170 million, still not profitable yet, but they're looking at being valued at upwards of $10 million. What's your thought on, or billion dollars, sorry, excuse me, $10 billion. That's right. What's your thought yeah. on Reddit going public and also at that valuation?
You know, I'm going to give you a giant no comment on that one. I will say, look, I will say in the wake of my resignation last June, I was really heartened to see, the company respond by banning, I think, 3,000 hate communities, by honoring my request to be replaced by a Black director. Like, I think those changes aren't just good for society. They're good for business. They're good for the bottom line. And seeing the company's revenue growth since then, as a result, it makes me so happy to see. So I think, I can't comment on any IPO plans. I do think at the end of the day, we've reached a new era in the last year as more and more people realize the power of community. And I just want to see it live up to the best of what community can do. And optimistic to see that happen.
And would love you to get your thoughts on Facebook. You know, it's been a tough few weeks. We had that whistleblower go before Congress to shed some light on problems internally there at Facebook. We've also got, they had a worldwide outage of Facebook and a lot of its apps. A lot of people talk about Facebook being like sort of the Teflon company. It keeps bouncing back. What about this time? Does this time feel different? And do you think maybe it's time for CEO Mark Zuckerberg to step aside and allow new management?
There's a lot there. with regard to your observation about the Teflon company, I do think, regulators are at an inherent disadvantage when they don't understand the technology that they seek to regulate. And, we saw it again recently with, I think it was a senator or a congressman asking about Finsta accounts as though they were a product. This makes the rounds in tech. Those are fake Instagram accounts. So anyone can create one that you use as like an alternate account. It's not your real name. It's like a pseudonym or what have you. There is such a gulf between the folks who understand the technology and the folks who are regulating it in almost all cases, which presents a really big challenge. Because a well-intentioned regulation can have really unintended consequences that don't actually solve the problem. And so at the risk of sounding a bit sort of cynical about it, I just don't know what will actually change from a regulatory or enforcement standpoint. I do think the greatest leverage, though, is from the market. We're already seeing, we are already backing companies that are like principally opposed to the sort of culture that Instagram has created. Companies like Dispo, where the goal is you take a photo and then you go back to living in the moment because you can't see it until the next day. And it's not about taking 100 perfect photos to Photoshop, make look amazing just to impress a bunch of strangers who don't actually care, Instagram. And I do think that momentum is actually going to end up moving a lot faster. And with regard to Zuck, I think does that come down to the shareholders voting? I don't know. I think one thing I would like to see broadly is it disappoints me when leaders lead by reacting as opposed to making hard decisions and actually leading from the front lines as opposed to just being reactive to press cycles or outcry or what have you. And it is hard. It is really hard. We're in territory that I don't think any of us expected. I started Reddit in 2005. I think Zuck started in 2003. Like, we were building things that we thought we would like and other college kids like us would like. And the reality is it's having much bigger implications on far more people than we ever expected. And part of that comes with the responsibility. And that's the part that I think every one of us is a bit fed up. Or a lot of us are fed up with seeing leaders react instead of lead and actually make hard choices that are, to accepting the reality of what an impact these platforms have.
Yeah, it's certainly going to continue to shake out over the weeks and months ahead. But from one Alexis to another, I thank you for spending time with us and sharing your thoughts. Alexis Ohanian, thank you.
Thank you, Alexis. Appreciate you having me.
Next time we'll have him on camera. All right, have a good weekend. A new study by Elevest finds that financial stress can indeed impact your health and your well-being. Here to break down the findings and help us all have a healthier relationship with our money is Elevest's co-founder and CEO, Sally Krawcheck. Sally, so good to see you again. It's been a while. I made my way through this report and found some of these findings to be rather enlightening. And I want to start with gender differences, because according to your survey, money is women's number one source of stress. Tell us why.
Number one source of stress, probably because we have less of it than men do, probably because while we talk so much about the gender pay gap at 82 cents to a white man's dollar, the wealth gap is at 32 cents to a white man's dollar. And for Black women, it's a penny. It was actually going in the wrong direction before the pandemic and went further in the wrong direction. So no wonder, you know, two thirds of women worry about money at least once a week. Half of women say it's negatively impacted their emotional and mental health. And 40% of women say that it's made them physically ill. So in fact, what we have here is a hidden pandemic. It's a second pandemic.
And I was struck by the fact that obviously you say that there's a gender gap, 36% of women, so more than one in three, think about these about financial issues on a daily basis compared to 28% of men. But I was really struck by the confidence gap that you say exists. Can you explain that?
Well, you know, you always hear that. You hear women aren't as confident about money, are risk averse when it comes to money, aren't as good investors as men. And none of these things are actually true. Women have about the same financial knowledge as men, but you have a lifetime of messages that women internalize that they are risk averse, that money isn't for them. They watch their mom coupon clip and invest. They see coupon clip and save. They watch dad invest. Something like 92% of articles written to women about money are negative, whereas 70% of articles written to men about money are positive. So it comes at them from all sides, and then they have less money than men. So they say, yeah, there it is. I'm not good at it because everybody tells me I have less, totally my fault. I feel sick.
Right. So it becomes like this self-fulfilling prophecy. So tell us, Sally, you're great with helping us find real world ways we can change the situation. If you want to have financial wellness in your life, what are some steps women in particular can start to make today?
Well, one that's a pretty easy step is 40%+ of women feel better about money if they simply talk about it. And it's interesting. We love to communicate and engage with on every topic, but we are much more likely to talk to our friends about sex and our own death than money. So if we can begin to have the conversations. And the second thing is, it isn't so tough. Financial wellness isn't financial independence. It really is stepping back. What do you have? Where are you going? Do you have a budget? Do you have a plan? Do you feel good about it? And of course, we at Elevest, if you come over to elevest.com, have any number of resources that are there to help women, non-binary individuals, women plus, to be more successful with their money.
And tell us, what are some of the things specifically that Elevest is doing in that regard for women?
Yeah, we are providing all kinds of education and recognizing that investing, for example, can be different for men and women, that we alone have in our investing algorithm a gender awareness. It doesn't matter as much if you're a man, but it matters a lot if you're a woman, because you earn less, because your salary peaks sooner, because you take more career breaks before, because you live longer. So you have to invest differently in order to achieve the same goals. And Elevest works that in, as well as recognizing those things and providing the tools and the education to help her move forward.
And I just want to pivot in this conversation for a minute, but still stick with women and talk about women in leadership positions within S&P 500, Fortune 500 companies. Sally, are you seeing that even through your lens at what you do at Elevest? Is that starting to improve?
A little bit. You know, we are, you know, we'll see so-and-so is, you know, become the CEO of such and such, and the number is now a record, not very good, but a record. Look, the problem is we face systemic issues. We face underlying issues. The gender pay gap starts when women have that first baby, because not every woman has got paid parental leave. So she's more likely to leave the workforce if she's not feeling well, if the baby's not well, if she wants to be with that baby. But even if she does take that leave, she gets put on the mommy track. And so until we have parental leave for all genders, sick leave for people who need it, leave if you have a miscarriage, if you have, you know, have to have some parental care, you know, for your parents, until we make those things equal and recognize that they are not cost, they are investments, only then can we really get to really begin to move towards equality. Otherwise, it's, you know, one or two steps forward, not big jumps forward.
Yeah. Sally Krawcheck, CEO of Elevest. Always good to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Consumers are continuing to spend, outspending what we expected to see in the month of September. Retail sales jumping just around 0.7%. We're looking at a couple of retailers moving to an upside, moving to the upside as a result. You can see some of those names on your screen right now: Walmart, Target, TJ Maxx, Macy's, Amazon, among the names gaining today. But let's talk a little bit more about this. We want to bring in Jerry Storch. He's Storch Advisor, CEO, the former CEO of Toys R Us. Jerry, it's always great to speak with you when we get these retail sales numbers out. I think some people were a little bit nervous about what the Delta variant could potentially do, what supply chain issues might be doing to retail sales now, yet we're seeing another number that beat expectations. What's your big takeaway?
Well, I thought all those fears were frankly quite overblown and kind of poppycock, because the only way you can look at this as an operator is to say, okay, the pandemic is starting to end. What do I compare these numbers to? People are in this habit, as your chart shows, of comparing this month's sales to last month's sales on some kind of seasonally adjusted basis by the Census Bureau. You know, that number is so engineered, I don't even know how to make any sense out of it. What I can make sense out of, I can say, let's go back before the pandemic began in 2019. What were sales in 2019, the last time we had sort of a level playing field, and what are they today? And guess what? For month after month after month, they've run about 20% higher than the equivalent month in 2019, in 2021. So for example, in July, sales were 18% higher than in 2019. In August, they were 19% higher. In September, 21% higher. So I would say it's about 20% within any kind of reasonable standard error room for measurement. That's actually phenomenal and unprecedented. If I had told you 2 years ago, when we never heard of the pandemic, that 2 years from now, sales would be 20% higher than they were in 2019, you'd think I was some kind of an extreme optimist, to say the least. You probably use other words. So sales have been phenomenal. Consumers on fire. This is no surprise to me. I've said it's coming. It's been consistent, by the way. That's the funny thing, or the interesting thing. Month after month after month, even as headlines try to make sense out of nonsense stuff, like variations from month to month in this 7/10 here, and then they adjust it and it's really 9/10, you know, that kind of thing. When the real number is just this enormous increase, which is why the ports are clogged and why everything else is going on.
Yeah, Jerry, speaking of the ports being clogged, I know you and I exchanged emails after Nike was out with its results, and that's just one of a number of retailers that came out warning about the supply chain crisis, what that could potentially do to sales, at least in the immediate term. But, I mean, you are somebody who has been an executive at a number of retailers. When you see an issue like this, I guess, how big of a worry is it for some of these companies? And if you were advising one of these firms, what would you tell them?
So first of all, it depends on who you are. So Nike's a fine company, but they have a concentrated source of supply in Vietnam. And that's the problem that they alluded to. So they had a specific issue. And, it means that they're going to be short their sneakers and they're not going to have the kind of sales increase they're looking for. It's very different if you're Target or Walmart or Costco, where, you know, if you don't sell one, you'll sell the other. If you're Amazon, if you don't sell one brand, you'll sell the other brand. There's still plenty of merchandise out there. Keep in mind that exports from China are up 30%. You know, even goods through the port of LA are up 20-30%. So it's not like they have an expanded capacity. It's just they couldn't possibly contain this unprecedented increase in demand. So if you're a retailer and you have any broad lines like Target, Walmart, Costco, Home Depot, you have plenty to sell and you're going to do just great. If you're Nike, all you have to sell is your own brand. And that could be an issue if you have that kind of constriction. Now, how do you fix it when you have a problem? Look, it's a lot bigger. You know, I'm not going to get into the politics of this, but you can't just say we're going to open the port, one port 24 hours a day, and suddenly the problem's solved. That's like, you know, like a hot dog eating championship. It doesn't do any good because you still got to swallow it all. And so even if you could bring all those ships in and all that cargo got unloaded in LA by some magic, there'd be no one to pick it up and take it to the import distribution center of the retailer. And not only that, if they got there to the import distribution center of the retailer, it would be full already. There'd be nowhere to put it away. And even if they did, there'd be no one to pick it and pack it to send it on another truck. If there were a truck to get it there, there wouldn't be. But if there were, to send it to the next DC down the line, the regional distribution center for the retailer, where they have to process it again. And again, they have a labor shortage. And then it has to go on other trucks to get to the store. So it's a pipeline, and you can't just fix it by looking at one place. So the answer is you have to set up a war room. It's like a, you know, use whatever metaphor you're comfortable with that day, whether it's a Manhattan Project or going to war. And you have to look at the whole pipeline and find every constriction point and work on them. And I don't see anybody doing that. We're certainly not doing this as a country right now by saying, oh, we'll open the port 24 hours ahead. That's just, you know, it's almost it's political. It's almost laughable as a solution to something that's a serious, multifaceted problem. So you have to, you don't go to sleep is what you do, and you solve it.
Yeah, Jerry, we've been talking to a number of guests over the last couple of days, and they were simply saying, okay, you can open the ports, exactly what you were just saying. You can open the ports, but even once you get some of these goods onto land, you simply don't have the labor that you need in order to get, like truck drivers, for example, in order to get these goods to where they need to go. Jerry, I guess when you take a look at a timeline of how big of a problem this is, the fact that you're saying this isn't something obviously that's going to get resolved overnight or it sounds like anywhere in the immediate term, I guess how long do you expect us to be dealing with this issue?
Oh, I think as long as demand keeps being elevated double digits like it is now, and make no mistake about it, that's what we're seeing. We're seeing compound annual rates of growth demand of over 10% a year, right? So as long as the economy is so hot, as long as consumers have so much liquidity and so much money to spend, then demand's going to be very high. And meanwhile, obviously, it's demand-supply issues. Supply of labor is depressed. Whether or not that's because, you know, people are frightened to go out because of COVID, I think there's some of that for sure. And so as COVID heals, then there'll be more labor onto the market, which would be fantastic. Or whether it's some people are, you know, the so-called proverbial being paid not to work and are comfortable with that, as long as that lasts, then you're going to have that kind of issue. Eventually, you reach an equilibrium. Capitalism is pretty cool. But I think it's going to take, you know, well into the next summer or so until this is resolved. Now, you know, unfortunately, what would really resolve it fast would be some kind of a big setback, a correction in the stock market, some kind of resurgence in COVID, something else that would suppress demand so much you wouldn't have the problem anymore. But we don't want that to happen. I think it's much more likely demand will stay high. It'll start to abate after the holidays, come down to more single digits year over year type of a growth like in the good old days. You know, and then meanwhile, supply of labor will slowly increase and we'll solve the problem. People are working on it. It will be solved. It's just not going to be solved quickly.
Jerry, if you had to pick one or two retailers right now that you think are best positioned heading into the next couple of months, what would they be?
Well, there's a few categories. There's a big multi-line retailers who, you know, are vast companies, have a broad assortment. So if they don't have one thing to sell, they'll sell you something else. That's Walmart, Target, Costco. You know, then there's the people who are so well positioned for where the consumer's head is right now. So people like Home Depot, for example. I mean, one of the biggest increases, if there was any surprise to me, on this month's retail sales report was the giant increase yet again in building materials. And they have been showing compounding double-digit rates of increase in their sales. So Home Depot is very good. Dick's Sporting Goods is very strong. You know, you see people selling, wanting to buy. A lot of sports demand is very high. People who were winners before the pandemic who should be winners when things reopen, people like TJ Maxx or Dollar General. And then I always have to include Amazon because keep in mind, they have their own supply chain. And so they deliver all the way to your house. No one else has that. And so, you know, everyone else has to deal with FedEx or UPS who are having huge problems right now. And I know as a fact, they're telling retailers, you know, we're not going to ship everything that you want and the prices are going to go up and we're not going to meet your deadlines. You better make sure a customer buys well before Christmas, all that. Amazon didn't have that problem. At least, you know, everyone's got issues getting labor, but they have their own army, if you will, so they can handle this themselves. So I think they're in very good position. People I just don't trust the numbers on are the people who are losing before the pandemic, who someone took victory laps like a Bed Bath & Beyond or Macy's or Kohl's and said, oh, see, we fixed all our strategic problems because our sales did better than expected during the pandemic. Well, they're still not as good on that two-year stack I'm talking about as all the other names that I mentioned. And meanwhile, they haven't really done anything to address their fundamental strategic issues. It doesn't address fundamental strategic issue to add a little more private label or to you know, remodel your stores or something. It just, they've got core issues about who they are and what they are and how much of the business should be online, how much in the stores, and how they're going to appeal to customers in a marketplace that's fundamentally changed. And they have not addressed those issues. So mall-based apparel, department stores, you know, et cetera. I think the people that were losing before, I think they're going to come out of that pandemic and lose again.
We will see. Jerry Storch, always great to get your opinion. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us. CEO of Storch Advisors, former CEO of Toys R Us. We look forward to having you back again soon.